Professor Kizer, welcome to SBS Radio's Armenian program.
Yeah, thank you.
The aim of the interview is to present you and your studies to the Armenian community. Could you talk a bit about yourself, your field of studies and interests?
Yes, I'm a historian trained in Switzerland at the universities of Zurich and Basel, but also Paris and Strasbourg in France. And I have soon been attracted to Near Eastern topics, Turkish topics, Ottoman topics, late Ottoman topics. And in fact, my field of interest in a broad sense is late Ottoman and post-Ottoman history, or if you prefer to say the modern Middle East or modern Levant. And in particular related to unresolved questions of violence, of genocide, of ethnic cleansing, of, in a way, crimes that always were covered and could not be illuminated or clarified, and thus had an impact, a fatal impact on political culture.
Are you based in Switzerland or Newcastle?
Yeah, now I am a fellow of the Australian Research Council. That's a fellowship of 4 years, so I will be a long time in Australia and maybe even a bit longer. And I'm based at the Center for the History of Violence at the University of Newcastle. And this is a very good place to do my studies, also to get new impulses to work comparatively. And so, yes, I'm in Australia for a good while.
You said your main interest is the late Ottoman history. What attracted you to that particular country and period?
Yes, that's in a way very concrete and personal. When I was a student in Basel in the early 1980s, I encountered refugees from Turkey. This was just after the big military putsch of 12 September 1980, so it's exactly 36 years ago. And I encountered these people. I learned new things for me, really a new world for me, because I never did in any way think a lot then at that time about Turkey or the Near East. I just had studied at the high school the ancient Greek and Hebrew and so I knew a lot about the antiquity, but nothing about really the contemporary history. So this encounter made me very curious, because I saw that there were extremely dramatic events and people and societies were absolutely impacted by this. And I began to study, I began to buy books, but remained unsatisfied. I did not find the books. I went to bookstores in Ankara, in Istanbul, because I had learned Turkish also at the same time. Yes, and this made me explore myself, the topics, and began myself to write books on the late Ottoman Empire. Of course, I must perhaps explain that I realized that, in fact, a lot of the problems that were problems of these young friends I encountered in Basel that had a long history. And in my mind, as a young historian, these were clearly centered in the late or latest Ottoman times. So I quite rapidly went back to the late Ottoman period, in particular to the latest decades, in my need to understand the present.
You mentioned that you learned Turkish. Is that the modern Turkish or ancient Ottoman Turkish?
Yes, first learned the modern Turkish, just to communicate with these refugees who were not in the first years were often not able to learn a new language. These were traumatized people. Many of them had been tortured. so I learned modern Turkish myself at that time. And only later, when I went to Paris in the early 90s, there at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales, the EHESS, I also began to learn the Ottoman Turkish. But I profited from a basic Arabic that I had learned at the University of Basel already in the 80s. So this was very useful to be able to read and learn and understand the Ottoman Turkish.
So have you done research in the Turkish archives?
I have done research in the Turkish, in the Ottoman archive in Istanbul, the Başkanlık Osmanlı Arşivi in the 90s. So this was for my book, Der verpasste Friede, the failed or the squandered peace in English or in Turkish, Öskalan Mishparish, because this was my dissertation that appeared in German but was translated into Turkish and edited four times. And I have worked then in the Ottoman archives. I also work still with Ottoman documents, but meanwhile I have also the means to have research assistants so that I can work more efficiently.
The Ottoman Empire was allied to Central Powers. Is there enough material in Austrian and German archives about the Ottoman Empire?
There is a lot of important material. So today the challenge is to bring the material together, but not only to bring it together and to show that you have been everywhere, but to reflect them all together, to have an idea of the whole picture, and then the whole precision that the knowledge of the archives gives you, then to write on the topics that are the topics in which you want to make progress our knowledge. Yes, of course, Austrian, but even more German archives are crucial.
Have you studied Armenians and the Armenian question in the Ottoman Empire?
I have really very early realized that this was at the core, in the center of really main problems concerning political culture in modern Turkey up to the present. So already in the 80s, I discovered the Armenian question as a key question in order to analyze and to understand more what are the real questions of within the so-called Eastern question. So the Eastern question, as we all know, is a main question of international diplomacy since the late 18th century. And as we see it before us, it continues. So the Middle East remains a big question for the world, for diplomacy. And the Armenian question stood openly in the center of the Eastern question in the late Ottoman time.
Could you talk about the articles you published or books you published on the subject?
Yes, I already mentioned the Squandered Peace. So this is a really a long study on the eastern provinces of the Ottoman Empire from the beginning of the Tanzimat in the 1830s to what I called the end of the interior conquest by the central state 100 years later, that is in the 1930s with the campaign, the Kemalist campaign in Dersim, today's Tunceli, that was at the same time really a massacre of the Kurdish Alevites there, but that included also a quite considerable number of Armenians who had survived the genocide 20 years earlier. So that's certainly perhaps the most important study, also in terms of impact, because it was also translated into Turkish and has been published by Ileti Shim, which is an important publisher in Turkey, and has been re-edited 4 times. I have done also different research between the 90s and now. So just shortly to say, I worked on the Ottoman diaspora in Switzerland, including also the Armenians. So Switzerland was a very interesting theater to understand what went on, especially among revolutionary groups in the early 20th century. Everybody knows, of course, that Lenin was in Switzerland, but also the Young Turks had for a while their center in Geneva, and the Armenians anyway, with Drosha, with the western center of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation that was based in Geneva. So this was also an important stage of my research, to have this look on the diaspora, because history, you have to understand it transnationally. And so this helped me a lot to better understand a couple of things. I have now actually turned back really to the center of the late Ottoman power with a biography of Talat Pasha. So everybody knows Talat Pasha, and above all the Armenians know Talat Pasha as the main responsible of what happened to them, of the genocide in 1915. And we lacked up to now really a scholarly biography of this most important political figure of the Ottoman 1910s. So my challenge, my huge, ambition is really to make a scholarly biography of this person that sheds a lot of light, of course, on the history of the 1910s, which was a watershed, which was a seminal catastrophe that still determines a lot also of the contemporary Turkey and Middle East. But at the same time, to shed light on political culture, and the political culture that unfortunately could not overcome during the 100 years that since then, the failures to which it bowed itself in the 1910s. And so I hope that this book will be very helpful to different people. And that's now my main research. Besides this, we have teams partly still in Switzerland, even if I'm now in Australia, but I commute from time to time. So we have already published last year a volume on World War I and the end of the Ottomans that gives really an important place to the Armenians and the Armenian question, because as I said you already, in my eyes, this is a key to understand a lot. It's not an obsession, it's a very sober assessment when I say this. And so this book that I just mentioned, and also the next one that we are preparing, for which we will have an international exploratory workshop, as we call it, at the University of Zurich in January. This will be a book where the Armenian genocide again figures very prominently, both with even more sophisticated research on the regional aspects, because there still is a need of sophistication, but what we may call a kind of agenda setting, new research of post-genocide matters, that is to see really the history of the Armenians, but not only of the Armenians, after the 1910s in Turkey, but also beyond in the diaspora, and so very clearly and soberly through the prism of what really happened before. And I would say it is new to have an open, uncomplexed approach of post-genocide matters. And so this will be a second very important part of this new volume with more than 20 authors.
Professor Kizer, you have researched the late Ottoman history. Do you see any similarities with the current situation in the Middle East and Turkey's foreign and internal politics?
Yeah, unfortunately, I would be happy not to see. Unfortunately, what the recent developments are, a kind of mix of Abdulhamid's palace politics and regime of the late 19th century. There is the element of the single party regime for which Talat stood as the main figure of the Young Turk, of the Committee, Union and Progress regime of the 1910s, that also, in fact, evolved after the nominally liberal putsch of July 1912. So that these were nominally liberals who feared that the Young Turks became more and more authoritarian. It was also exactly at the same time, the summer 1912, when the ARF, the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, ended its coalition alliance with the CUP because they had been revolutionary brothers during the Young Turk Revolution, during the Ottoman Spring of 1908. So, unfortunately, there is a kind of similarity. So there was a putsch, in fact, against the Young Turks in 1912. Then there were the outbreak of the Balkan Wars in the fall, and the CUP, and above all, Talat was a real warmonger at that time, and could win over the patriotic circles and then, in fact, implement a real definitive putsch in January 1913 that installed the Young Turk dictatorial regime that lasted until autumn 1918, so that dominated the whole World War I in the Ottoman world. So if I say yes, unfortunately, I see similarities with today's new palace regime in Ankara. I must add the person-centric aspect of Kemalism that is taken up as well in what we see before us now, and at the same time a dramatic destruction, deconstruction of democracy, of the balance of powers of the three different powers, parliament, judiciary and the executive. So yes, we are not happy to see this, even less happy to see this now evolve like this in the name of democracy, as you may know, is the political discourse in Turkey.
United States is a major player in the Middle East politics, yet a century ago didn't have much involvement except some missionaries. As a historian, why do you think, the late interest from the United States in the region?
Yeah, that's a good question. The United States were indirectly very present through the missions, as you said. They had not yet a strong political and economic presence, because, in fact, the missionaries with their schools, with their hospitals, and with their holistic hopes for the whole Levant as the Bible lands as the promised lands, as the lands of the future. So they were, in fact, the Americans. It's, of course, because the United States, according to the Monroe Doctrine, did not want to be active in the old world meaning Europe and the Levant and the Eastern question. So it took World War One, then the decision to intervene, then the new vision by Woodrow Wilson for a new world order after the seminal catastrophe of the World War, that slowly the United States really became involved. But it took the Second World War even before they really became involved also militarily. So it's interesting to see this long evolution and change, yes, because this was in a way so sensitive territory, and because this was also the projection of millennialist hopes there. So there was a lot of hesitation to come there with realpolitik in a way. But that's a huge topic. I wrote a book on this. It's called American Millennialism, or the main title is Nearest East, American Millennialism and Mission to the Middle East. So I really delve into these, in my eyes, very interesting topics, because I myself look at the Middle East now, of course, all the times, as you see, with the eyes of a modern historian, of a historian of modern times, that is now in the narrow sense, that means since the late 18th century. But at the same time, I have a good knowledge also of the antiquity, also of the Bible. And so I take also of Zionism, also of Jewish history. So I have a broader perspective behind, and I'm very much interested, and I also try to read the religious scripts that play in the Middle East, also in today's Middle East. I must say, even much clearly in the Middle East, sometimes in extreme ways. So that's another aspect. We have to do, in a way, all the times with 3,000 years of history, even if we deal with the contemporary history of the Middle East.
Professor Kitzer, University of Newcastle's Center for the History of Violence, that you're a fellow. What is the purpose of the center? Why specifically research violence in history?
Yes, of course, you may say smilingly that academics need from time to time trendy topics. And you are not totally wrong if you smile at this. At the same time, I think, and I would very clearly also argue that violence is a crucial topic and deserves to be looked at really directly as a main topic. It allows you to see also old topics from new perspectives. So, for example, I would take an example. You can analyze and discover violence in power relations, in empire, in imperial situations, and then you can compare this, be it the Ottoman Empire, be it the British Empire, be it other empires, or be it imperial situations in a way where power relations are similar or analogous to those of in empires. So this center is a real hub for this new approach of history, a real hub for Australia, but also internationally. So you see me here anyway. I'm from Europe, from Switzerland. So I have been attracted here. It's, of course, also good to have the distance that I enjoy here in Australia. vis-à-vis the topics to which I was very close all the time. We have a number of people, of good people, people working on very different topics, but we can look at these various topics through common notions. And by the way, there is also now planned and has started a very broad project that should end as a Cambridge, a four-volume Cambridge history of the violence, where many dozens authors together, I think 150 authors all in all, will deal with the topics of violence in history. And so it's a way to reorganize, reanimate historical studies. And coming back now to the Middle East, to Ottoman history, late Ottoman history, post-Ottoman history, I think it's an absolutely necessary focus, violence. And the word itself is neutral, I would say. So, it's a very elementary word. So you can have a fresh approach to genocide, to failures within political culture. Even you may include also domestic violence. So it goes really down to human basics, and that's necessary. You have always again come back down to human basics. That violence, if you want, is the failure of the respect for the neighbor, and these are the real and basic questions.
One more last question about the silence on the Armenian genocide in Australia. Looking from the eyes of a European historian, why do you think, given the importance of the Gallipoli campaign in Australian national conscience, Australian historians shy away from the subject?
I do not think that all shy away. Now we have this new volume with Peter Stanley, for example. I know that my colleagues here at the Center for the History of Violence are absolutely open to this topic, but you are surely right when saying that not a lot had been studied, and probably you mean also on the political level there is not has not much been done, if I understand you correctly.
Yes.
But in New South Wales, as far as I know, there is the recognition of the Armenian genocide already since the 1990s. So, yes, I personally was really struck by the intensity of the Remembrance Day for the Gallipoli campaign. I was there early in the morning in Newcastle this year, and at the same time really struck by the absence of any reference to what happened at the same time with the Armenians, so with the Armenian leaders, intellectuals in Constantinople, really at the same time. And that, in fact, if the Gallipoli campaign had succeeded, then the Armenian genocide would not have happened like it happened. But, of course, if we are a bit more historical, then we must say that, in fact, the Gallipoli campaign, because too much focus on this campaign, even if it failed since the start, there were a lot of failures, instead of going to Iskenderun and making there a landing, that would have been much more easy, and that would certainly have stopped the second phase of the Armenian genocide. So Gallipoli is a failure in every sense. And it's worth me remembering, so I'm absolutely not against this day of remembrance, but I am for a full remembrance. And to remember failure is healthy, is necessary for humans. So we need, in a way, to complete this Australian culture of memory I say this very urgently from my side as a historian of this period.
Professor Kizer, we discussed some aspects of a huge topic. I'm sure we will have more time in the future to discuss further with you. Thank you for your time and the interview.
Thank you also. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about all this.